Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode XCVI, Dictator of Rome, which, for those playing at home, was the original name of this podcast way back when it was a mini-series on Julius Caesar, at which point it all got a bit out of hand, and, well, 4 years later, here we are. The first triumvirate is over, but for Julius Caesar, he got his desired outcome. He's now poised with an army to march into Rome. Over the next few years, he will exert influence over the empire, and his legacy will bring an end to the Roman Republic. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
When Caesar crosses the Rubicon in 49 BCE, he's declaring war on the Senate. He's doing something that no Roman commander should do, and he's changing the course of history, which is why we think of Rubicon as meaning no way back. Mm. And Caesar is supposed to have said the famous phrase that the die is cast, right? He's shown his hand. He can't change his mind now.
What is he hoping to get out of it? When he gets to Rome, does he want at this point absolute power? Does he just want control over the Senate? Is it his intention to make himself a dictator or even more? What does he want out of doing this?
Well, it's quite hard for us to mind read Caesar at this point. The immediate desire seems to be to beat the Senate at their own game, which is at least some people in the Senate want to put him on trial. So the spur that puts him onto this is avoiding going on trial for having misbehaved in the Gallic War, for having declared war on a friend of Rome. But of course, there is a bigger game here. And it's been clear throughout at least the late 50s that he and Pompey are coming to loggerheads. So it's not surprising that it helps that he's bringing in an army with him.
Yeah.
He kind of has to bring that army to be at the head of the army to not be prosecuted. But you get the feeling Caesar must know and Pompey must know that this is where it's been going for a few years.
Mm.
So it's actually quite fortunate that he's had to bring the army with him. And he can make it look like I had no choice, that the Senate has pushed me to this. So I would say at this point, if I had to mind read Caesar, that what he's looking for is conflict with Pompey that he can win and therefore can become what this whole century has been leading to, which is one man in charge at Rome.
Yeah, but he would have looked at what Sulla had before and what Marius had before and maybe had that in mind as a starting point.
Yes, well, he doesn't want to go down the road of Marius, which is losing a war.
Yeah.
So that's not his role model there. But of course, Marius had previously been extremely successful. And Marius is his role model as a popularist politician.
Mm.
Sulla is not from that point of view. In fact, one of the things Caesar will do once he gets real power is to reverse a lot of Sulla's policies. But he probably is looking at Sulla's success. Now, of course, remember that Sulla's role as a model is to have had dictatorship, to have had the position of dictator, but give it up.
Yep.
So maybe that's what Caesar had in mind. It's not exactly what will happen.
And what is Pompey's motivation then? Is he simply cast as the opposite of Caesar in this, or has he got an agenda of his own?
Well, a lot of ancient historians are very cynical about both Caesar and Pompey at this point. So whereas Caesar has in the past been thrust forward as the man of the people who's defending the people's rights, which to a limited extent I would agree with. And Pompey is now becoming the defender of the Senate, the defender of tradition. A lot of modern ancient historians would say they both just want power. They're just using either the Senate or the people to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, there is a little bit of evidence for Pompey that this is the case. It does come from people like Plutarch, who were a fair while later, 150 years later. But Plutarch says, even Pompey, although in words he affected to decline the honour of being dictator, in fact did more than anyone else to effect his appointment. But Cato saw through his design and persuaded the Senate to appoint him sole consul. So this is in 52 BCE when Pompey was sole consul, going back a little bit. And what Plutarch is implying is that at that point, Pompey was after total control. So your consul, it's very definitely for a limited time. Dictator's meant to be, but it can kind of be extended in a time of crisis. And it really, you know, you never have somebody in power with you as dictator. You never have someone who can veto you. So being sole consul is kind of a fudge of that because there's no other consul to veto you, but it is for a limited amount of time. And Cato, who remember is the hardline defender of the Senate and for process and for tradition, doesn't want any kind of system that promotes effectively monarchy, ongoing absolute power. Even though Pompey will be on his side, at least militarily, he sees Pompey as trying to get to what Caesar did get to, which is absolute power. Mm. So there's a lot of mistrust here. And I think that this source is as close as we can get to saying that people at least thought that Pompey had the same motives.
So Caesar crosses the Rubicon, and as always in situations like this, there are a few handy portents that happen to occur to show that something significant is happening. I like a good portent.
Yeah, we always get them. And previously when we've looked at emperors, we usually get them for emperors' deaths as well, don't we?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here we get from Appian, "It rained blood." This is pretty dramatic stuff.
This gets biblical.
"Sweat issued from the statues of the gods. Lightning struck several temples." That sort of stuff happened all the time.
Yeah.
"A mule foaled." Well, mules are normally infertile, so they can't give birth.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, so that's the problem there. Mm. And often it is to do with births, you know, something with multiple heads is born or sometimes multiple other organs when they cut it up.
And I think my favourite might be Pertinax, a horse falling off the roof.
It was just a drunk horse, probably.
It was a sign, apparently.
What's it doing on the roof?
I don't know.
I wonder if that's actually less literal than you think, and it's a statue from a quadriga.
Nah.
Where the horse has fallen off.
Horse fell off the roof.
Sorry.
Don't ruin my dream. Read this bit from Appian now to set us on our way. Caesar crosses the Rubicon. Off he goes.
Also, Appian tells us in his Civil Wars, "Caesar, meanwhile, hastened to Rome. He found the people shuddering with recollection of the horrors of Marius and Sulla, and he cheered them with the prospect and promise of clemency."
Mm.
So he promises mercy, which in a lot of ways he'll live up to. But it's interesting that Appian points out that people are really over civil war already. They don't want this again. And this is, by and large, I mean, you can't speak for everybody, but a populace, the ordinary people tend to back Caesar. That's where he's got a lot of his power from. And so even they are a little bit hesitant. You know, they've been through proscriptions, or maybe their parents have. They've been through the chaos of the last few years where there's organized violence in the city and gangs, and they kind of don't want that on a larger scale with an army. Caesar has to reassure them. He has to give them some confidence in him.
So we're not going to look at the civil war in too much detail in this podcast. Suffice to say, Pompey's resistance to Caesar isn't hugely effective.
No, he leaves the city. He tries briefly to rustle up some forces in southern Italy, but he ends up leaving from the port of Brundisium to go off towards Greece and basically heads east.
Mm.
And he'll end up in Egypt in 48 BCE. All the time he's trying to get more backing, but this fails disastrously in Egypt because he reads the signs wrong and Ptolemy wants to give him up to Caesar. Mm. So he has Pompey killed and beheaded and the head offered to Caesar.
And Caesar isn't very happy about this at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, he kind of wanted to take care of Pompey himself, and some foreigners done it for him. So that's the end of Pompey, but the war doesn't end in 48. It goes on for another 3 years with the Pompeians, or the Republicans, or the senatorial band continuing the war. So even though they've lost their main military leader, the resistance continues.
And most of the Senate at this point, it's probably safe to say that Caesar will have his supporters in the Senate, but a lot of people, especially the traditionalists, do not want Caesar to have his way. So that's why you've got the resistance.
Yes, exactly.
So is this seen as the Republic against Caesar?
Yeah, that's how a lot of people see it. And often the Pompeian side is called the Republicans, even at this stage, as opposed to the Caesarians. And that is then continued into the subsequent wars as well. Historians do tend to see this as the ultimate outcome of that optimates versus populares tension that we've had going on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a feeling that Caesar will be less observant of the constitution of the Republic than Pompey would. It's already unclear whether Pompey would really be fully observant.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had Caesar in the year he was consul running the show on his own and not paying any heed to his fellow consul, effectively blocking him. So there's more worry from those who are traditionalists about Caesar being in charge.
Also, if Caesar's coming at you with a big army from Gaul, it's pretty plain what his agenda is going to be, whereas Pompey, there's at least a bit of hedging of the bets that things might be okay. I don't want to say the lesser of two evils, but they definitely know what the outcome would be with Caesar, and that's one that they want to avoid.
Yeah, at this stage, Pompey is seen as the heir to Sulla, and Sulla had been a defender of senatorial power.
Mm.
So if we think of it in terms of defending their power, then the Senate generally has more to gain by backing Pompey.
So Caesar wins the civil war, and that takes time. In the meantime, he does take control of Rome.
Yes. So Caesar is appointed dictator in 49 BCE, and then again in 46. And Appian tells us about the first time Caesar proceeded to Rome, where the trembling people chose him dictator without any decree of the Senate and without the intervention of a magistrate. So this is not the normal way to become dictator.
Mm.
And Appian's very definitely leading us down a certain path by saying trembling people, that they're terrified of what will happen
if they say no.
Yeah. I mean, you could read it two ways, couldn't you? That they're terrified about what will happen if no one's in control.
Okay, yeah.
But it's certain that this is a dire situation and that's why he gets to be in charge. He might have created that situation, you could argue.
Mm. So. And at this point, he's not a permanent dictator. This is a temporary role.
As it's meant to be.
Yeah, and being changed into a permanent role is a further change of the way that things operate later on, isn't it?
Yes, well, in 45, he will become dictator forever, permanent dictator, and release coins that say that. I think that might be the biggest undermining of the Republican constitution that Caesar carries out, because it turns everything on its head. This is a role for crisis, and it implies in a way that the state will be in crisis unless he is there to hold it together, that things will never be right again without Caesar. Which is really disingenuous.
So those senators who are in Rome and who see themselves as the opposition to Caesar's rule, what was their perspective on all of this? They must have been concerned, and we see that from Cicero, don't we?
We do. We see this in Cicero's letters, and we see it in what's written about Cicero's response. And Cicero has sort of been sitting on the fence. You know, he's really hoping that there wouldn't be a civil war. And so he doesn't want to choose sides. And ultimately, he's going to have to choose for the Senate because that's Cicero's makeup.
Mm.
But Plutarch tells us that he was actually the first to propose honours for Caesar in the Senate. And these first honours, Plutarch says, their magnitude was, after all, not too great for a man, even though it is basically tyranny. Cicero is clearly at this point hoping to control the amount of tyranny, so offer Caesar some power, offer him some apparently absolute power. What he's always going to try and tie it back to is the Republican Constitution. But, says Plutarch, others added excessive honours and vied with one another in proposing them, thus rendering Caesar odious and obnoxious even to the mildest citizens because of the pretension and extravagance of what was decreed for him. And by the way, if you want some instance of what that extravagance might have been, we could maybe turn to Appian, where Appian says Caesar was proclaimed father of his country, chosen dictator for life and consul for 10 years. His person was declared sacred and inviolable. It was decreed he should always transact business on a throne of ivory and gold, which is quite a statement, isn't it? You should never do any business with the Senate or magistrates unless you're on a throne, which is a symbol of monarchy, and a very valuable, ostentatious throne, ivory and gold. So that makes him look like a king. Caesar's sort of chipping away at the boundaries. So there are things like, at one point, it's okay for him to wear his triumphal garb all the time, which nobody's been allowed to do except on the day of their triumph before. He's sort of chipping away at what's allowed. But he's not chipping away at it slowly enough for it not to be obvious to most people that this is kingship. And, you know, Caesar has been away in the East. We've completely swept over this, but he's been in Egypt with Cleopatra. He's seen the kind of adulation and power that Hellenistic monarchs have. And it's no doubt that that is a role model for him.
But he's actually kind of seen, and this kind of gives me the perception of somebody who would like to be worshipped.
Yeah, and I think that certainly there's a theory later on, and I think it might be operating here too, that when we do have emperors in Rome, they're worshipped as gods in the East. Mm. And there's a sort of fudging of the facts there. So the Romans don't do that, but they allow it to happen in the East. And this is modeling on what they've done for the Hellenistic monarchs.
In Egypt.
So, yeah, in yeah. Egypt and in Asia Minor, in Pergamon. Mm. So no doubt Caesar has seen this happen, where Hellenistic monarchs are basically worshipped as gods during their lifetime. Now, he can't openly allow that to happen, but there's sort of an inching towards this in terms of the iconography, in terms of the using of a throne, in terms of Mark Antony at one point trying to present him with a crown to see if that was acceptable to the Romans, which it isn't.
The crowd doesn't react well to that, do they? Yes.
So we're sort of getting towards what we tend to have in the East and seeing how far we can go with that.
So this all becomes a bit too much for the Senate, and Caesar is assassinated in 44 BCE. I know I footnoted a lot there. Don't worry, everybody. We'll get to it at some point. This happens in the theater of Pompey.
How ironic.
Yeah, Pompey must love that little touch there.
Right at the feet of his enemy's statue, where the Senate is meeting. Mm. It's not the Senate House, the theater of Pompey.
So this is seen as a victory for the Republic, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And that's how the assassins saw it. So Brutus and Cassius are the famous ones. Mm. And they probably thought they'd be hailed as liberators. Certainly they released coins which had symbols on them of liberation. They didn't see it as something to be ashamed of. But they didn't read the people very well because they had to flee.
Mm.
They were seen as murderers.
Yeah.
And if you see it in line with assassinations we've previously discussed... I never thought I'd say that line. Assassinations we've previously discussed in this podcast. What happened to the Gracchi, for instance?
Mm-hmm.
The assassins pretty much got away with it.
Yes.
But things have changed. And now we have really strong factions, really strong backing for Caesar. And they're not going to get away with it. He has heirs and those close to him, people like Mark Antony, who's an experienced general.
Mm-hmm.
Is he just going to let this go? No. Brutus and Cassius have to also flee off to the east. This is what people who stand up to Caesar have to do, apparently, leave the country and go off to Greece.
So at this point, there's another civil war. And it's hard for me at this point to know which side is fighting for the Republic and the Senate. It seems to change a bit in between there and just end up being a war for Rome with powerful people.
Well, it's a war for who will be in charge of Rome. You can certainly see it as the Caesarians, which is Mark Antony and Caesar's heir, Octavian, fighting against the assassins. And they see it as a fight of revenge, vengeance to catch the people who murdered Caesar. So they would not style it as civil war. They'd see it as putting down a faction of murderous intent.
Yes. But very quickly at that point, it becomes between Octavian, Caesar's heir, and Mark Antony, who thinks that he should be Caesar's heir. Or something else to that effect.
Well, during the 30s, power shifts around a lot.
And then Rome against Egypt in some ways.
Yeah, well, that's how Octavian wants to depict it, because he doesn't want to see it as a civil war. And he doesn't want to have to march Roman troops in his triumph afterwards, because, spoiler, Octavian wins.
Yeah.
It is a civil war. It involves Mark Antony, a Roman. But because he's involved foreign troops and a foreign queen, it can be styled as a foreign war. It doesn't happen quite as quickly as we've perhaps implied there.
It doesn't happen that quickly at all.
But throughout the 30s, well, there's another triumvirate for one thing, the second triumvirate, which is a real triumvirate, dividing power between Octavian, Mark Antony, and a third guy, Lepidus. They didn't learn the lessons of the first one. It's not going to stick together. It does fall apart, particularly when Mark Antony moves over to Cleopatra and Egypt and is seen as possibly someone trying to move power east.
Mm.
So it's inevitable. We're going to end up with another civil war. Battle of Actium in 31 BCE, where Mark Antony and Cleopatra flee and lose, and eventually they kill themselves back in Alexandria a year later.
So at this point, it feels like the Senate gives up pretenses that they're going to be Republic anymore. They pretty much hand the keys to Rome over to Octavian.
Well, it's interesting that you say they give up pretense, because in a way, Octavian and the Senate, I guess, make more of a pretense than they ever have before. Yes, they give a lot of power to Octavian. Mm. They give him the name Augustus as an honorific in 27 BCE. And they also give him a lot of constitutional power. Or at least they give him the tribunician veto. He's got tribunician power.
Yeah.
So even when he's not consul, and he frequently is, he has that power of veto, and, you know, he can hold it over people that he's going to use it. And he has a lot of authority. But he says, and they presumably accept that he has given all power of the Republic back to the Senate.
Yeah, but that's a horse of a completely different colour, though. I mean, he's not consul, he's higher than that. He's not dictator, he's higher than that. Nobody can veto him, nobody can say anything against him. They've essentially got a monarchy without an heir signed on.
Yeah, they give him the title princeps. But you see, this is what I mean, that it looks like the Republic, because the term princeps means first man. It existed in the Senate. It was usually the oldest person in the Senate.
Mm.
He's nowhere near the oldest person in the Senate.
He's not even old enough to be consul.
He was born in 63. I'm doing quick maths here. 33. No, he's not. He's still in his 30s.
Thank you.
Quite right.
Luck that one out.
He's also, remember, because Caesar has been deified, we've also brushed over that, after a comet was supposedly seen at his funeral. So Octavian, who's been adopted by Caesar in his will, is now the son of a god, which gives him an awful lot of authority. And I think it's quite hard for us to imagine how strange this was. And it comes later, lots of Roman emperors will be deified after they die. It seems normal, but something the Romans do. But they hadn't done it.
Mm.
They hadn't done it since mythological times, declared a mortal person who has died a god. It's people like Romulus, you know, who were sort of legendary history, who have been deified.
At what point then can you point to and say, this is probably when we should definitely think that there's a changeover between Republic and Empire? Because strictly speaking, it's around this point. Caesar is a dictator. He's not the first emperor. Augustus is the first emperor. So where's the changeover point between Republic and Empire?
I've always put it in 27 because that seems to me a good date. But I'm fully aware that that is with the benefit of hindsight. All right, at this point, Augustus isn't being called an emperor. There's a lot of fudging of terms here. So he's imperator, which strictly speaking means general, but it's where we get the word emperor from. He is princeps, which becomes synonymous with emperor.
So is it him getting that title, him being made Augustus and princeps?
Yes. And also something that becomes a trademark of the emperor is that they get tribunician power. All of the emperors who follow will be given that. And the fact that he's got that is very meaningful. Now, some people would say it doesn't really happen until 23 BCE when he's given much more formalized powers. So they kind of tighten things up in 23 and consolidate his power with what's called the Second Settlement. But it's certainly on the cards in 27 and nothing goes wrong for Augustus. And he gets rid of all his enemies. He does what Caesar failed to do. Caesar did show clemency. Augustus doesn't. He wipes out.
Learned from that mistake.
Yeah. Anyone who could be a threat.
So January 27 BCE.
I would put that as the point. Whether Augustus knew it at the time or not, and whether the Senate knew it at the time or not. I mean, some people would say it doesn't happen until the next emperor comes along, where it's clear that it's going to be a dynasty. I'd put it right here.
Yeah. And I think that at this point, it's clear that the Republic, the Senate, are not going to have power the way that they did ever again. They're not going to be as relevant to Rome as they were before dictators/emperor.
Yeah. And we don't have civil wars after this point until we get to the death of Nero. To that extent, you know, this fight for the one person who'll be in charge or some way of resolving it is over.
Mm.
Augustus has solved that problem.
So when you look at the entire, this is what the Roman Republic was before 133 BCE, an entire six episodes ago, and this is what we're left with now with the rule of Augustus beginning, what do you think we should take out of this as the major beats of this happened, which led to this happening, which led to this happening, which led to the fall of the Roman Republic?
Okay. Well, the way I would see it is probably different to the way the Romans saw it. They often saw it as too much luxury led to their downfall and things like that. But they also could see that there was a great inequity. There were problems with land. I mean, they often tried to pass policies to deal with that. And that's why the Gracchi really come to prominence. So we've got these latifundia, these huge estates that are putting a lot of people off their land, creating a lot of discontent, which creates a body of people who will follow somebody who seems to represent their interests. That's certainly an important stage in cutting away the Republic. We've got the abuse of the position of dictator, getting rid of anyone who stands in your way. So especially that kind of gang warfare that happens in the 50s in Rome between Pompey's mob and Caesar's mob, but it's been happening already with the assassination of the Gracchi and others. A lot of tribunes of the plebs, actually, a lot of tribunes of the people murdered. All of these things are extra constitutional. There's some attempts to change the way Rome is run legally. That's the attempts at land reform, all right, try and get that through the Senate and do it in the proper way. But they're always blocked. So it's this blocking of the land reform that leads to people doing things extra constitutionally. And it really gets out of hand to the point where the Republican constitution is not valid anymore. It won't allow this to change. Therefore, it itself has to change.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, and I mean, we see this happen in modern societies as well, a republic will only last for long as everybody says that it will last. It will change if enough people start getting unhappy with it. Then you've got powerful personalities that might come to the fore and try and get more power. So republics are really fragile.
That's a scary idea, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, we see it happening, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think that in the second century BCE, nobody would have foreseen that Rome would become a monarchy again. They would have assumed that monarchs had been thrown out and were hated, were really despised by the Romans. It was anathema to them. So they would have been shocked that a century later, that's effectively what they had. But they created enough discontent. You know, those with the power to change things assumed that nobody would ever overthrow them. They assumed that they'd be safe. They didn't foresee the conditions under which they would become irrelevant to the vast majority of people.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please consider leaving us a review. We appreciate the validation. You can follow Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and both myself and Rhiannon are on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. The Roman Republic has now fallen. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.